Good morning. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. I understand that counsel have announced to the clerk the time you wish to argue, and everyone's here and present and ready to go. All right. Our clerk will call the first case.
The court will now call Joshua Hill, first state of Texas. And may it please the court, Mr. Raymond Williams, argue for the appellate, and Mr. Edward Wilkinson, argue for the defense.
May it please the court. My name is Reagan Nguyen. I am here on behalf of the appellant in this matter, Josh Hill. Josh Hill was tried and convicted of molesting his two biological daughters over a 3 to 4 year period total. He was sentenced to 30 years in prison without the possibility of parole. The fundamental question that the jury had to answer in this case was, did they believe these two girls? I mean, the girls' credibility is really the only issue, factual issue, in contest at the trial. Mr. Hill did not testify, so to the extent this case is a swearing match, it's a one-sided swearing match. And the jury had to decide if they believed those girls beyond a reasonable doubt or not.
Mr. Nguyen, weren't there other relatives who testified in addition to the two children about the incidents of the night whenever he was confronted and he admitted to them that he committed the offenses?
Say that he did not make a direct admission. He made something that could be interpreted as an admission depending on how the jury believed it or heard it. But again, the facts and circumstances under which that admission was made, and this all ties back to our real issue in this case, again, I believe the fundamental question is, let me put it this way. I don't believe his admission would have been enough for a jury to find him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt without the two girls giving the detailed testimony they did about what it was they said he did to them.
Okay, thank you.
To understand the evidentiary issue in this case, there's some things about the timing of these events that are important. I'm going to refer to them in oral argument as injured party one and injured party two. Okay, injured party one is the first outcry. According to her testimony, she was abused between the ages of approximately 9 to 13 or 14 between 2008 and 2012 or 13. Injured party two, according to her testimony, was abused from approximately ages 11 to 13 between 2009 and 2011. There is no mention of this abuse to anyone, as far as the record reveals, whether it's a friend or an adult, until 2014. And what happens in 2014, May of 2014, by this point, these two girls are in high school. And injured party one has been getting in trouble for sexting and some other sexual conduct, and she gets caught having sexual contact with a boy in the boys' bathroom at school. And her mother, her biological mother, and her stepfather come down on her pretty hard, and she gets in trouble over this over the summer. And then that is the first time that she ever mentions to anyone, as far as the record reflects, that her father had molested her, and she didn't tell an adult. She told her some of her friends over the summer. A few months later, November of 2014, the first injured party, who's been living under these new stricter rules from her parents, turns out that she had taken her sister, the other injured party's, iPad and had been sexting, sending naked pictures of herself to another boy. Mom finds out about it. They go to get her at school, and they confront her with this sexual conduct. And it is that moment, she's literally in the car, November 2014, now mind you, this is several years after the alleged abuse, and she says, essentially, well, this is Dad's fault because he was molesting me. And that is where that is how these accusations came to light. On top of that, you have the state putting this forensic interviewer up as an expert witness to say, kids who have been abused can often pull from, she called it, sensory and peripheral details that they would not be able to pull if it wasn't true. So this isn't that in the general I was molested, but that this is what something felt like. This is what it sounded like. This is what it smelled like. And they're able to remember these peripheral details that the idea of the expert testimony was they wouldn't be able to pull those up unless it had really happened. She also talked about script memory, which was that something you do that happens over and over and over, like driving to work was the example she gave. Like you may not be able to remember any particular day driving to work, but you know you would drive every day the same way. And so you can pull from your script memory for something that's happened repeatedly. And the script memory, she says that's only the second girl, or that was the only one she caught it on. The peripheral and sensory details, that's both girls. And what she essentially testified to was those are things that those girls exhibited that are consistent with children who've been abused. Outside the presence of the jury, she admitted that if the girls had been having other sexual contact and other sexual experiences, that those experiences could have been what caused them to have the sensory or the recall of the sensory and peripheral details or the recall from script memory. Finally, you have, and I'll talk about harm in a minute, where this I think this really comes in, just the general idea that these girls would not have this sexual knowledge that they had to be able to talk about these details unless Mr. Hill had done these things to them. For all those reasons, the defense should have been allowed to prove that both girls had been having sexual intercourse, had engaged in other sexual conduct, and had engaged in sexual misconduct to some extent, at least in violation of home and school rules. I think that the two cases that are most important for you to look at are Hammer and Johnson. I'm going to start with Hammer. Hammer is a 2009 Judge Cochran opinion out of the Court of Criminal Appeals, and I would submit that my experience has been, if you want to know what the law is on an area, try and find a Judge Cochran opinion, because they tend to lay it out pretty well. And she went through a very lengthy explanation of what the law is about confrontation and the rules of evidence in a sexual assault case. And she starts out, this discussion's on pages 561 to 62, she starts out by saying something I think is pretty obvious. Trials involving sexual assault may raise particular evidentiary and constitutional concerns because the credibility of both the complainant and defendant is a central, often dispositive issue. These are frequently he said, she said trials in which the jury must reach a unanimous verdict based solely upon two diametrically different versions of an event, unaided by any physical, scientific, or other corroborative evidence. And she says that the rules of evidence should be used sparingly to exclude relevant, otherwise admissible evidence that might bear upon the credibility of either the defendant or the complainant in these kinds of cases. And that the Constitution requires great latitude when the evidence deals with a witness's specific bias, motive, or interest to testify in a particular fashion. And that's the important takeaway from Hammer, specific versus general. She goes on to explain that Davis v. Alaska tells us that your right to confrontation, when you're talking about a specific bias or motive, that's what confrontation protects. And all the cases that talk about it's not doesn't mean full cross-examination, there can be limits. The limits are too general. But a specific bias or motive is always subject to proper cross-examination under the Sixth Amendment. And that's what Judge Cochran told us in Hammer. You then get to Johnson, which is a case in which the Court of Criminal Appeals reversed an en banc decision of this court in a very similar case. In Johnson, it was tried in Wichita Falls, the trial court allowed the defense to prove, kind of like they did here, there was generally the children had get in trouble and there were these general issues. But they didn't let them get into the specific. And this court said, well, you get to make reasonable limitations on cross-examination. We don't think this was all that important. And what the Court of Criminal Appeals came in and they said, no, this was tied to a specific bias or motive. And it's a Sixth Amendment violation to stop it, to stop that cross-examination. This leads me into the harm analysis. We submit that the harm standard, appropriate harm standard in this case, is the 44.2A standard for constitutional harm. In other words, for you to find the error harmless, you would have to find beyond a reasonable doubt that it did not contribute to the conviction or punishment. In other words, you'd have to find a negative beyond a reasonable doubt. And I think it has to be constitutional because of what Judge Cochran told us in Hammer. It becomes a Sixth Amendment violation when it is specifically tied to that bias or motive. I would also refer to the court, and I would like to send a post-submission letter brief in. There's a case that came out actually the day before I filed my brief, and I didn't see it. It was called Golladay versus State, G-O-L-L-I-D-A-Y. Came out of this court. It's unpublished. It's 2016, Westlaw 5957022. Now, that's a sexual assault case about a swearing match. And the thing that I think is important for our harm analysis is the court, without a lot of fanfare, said, yeah, this is a constitutional violation, confrontation and due process right to present a defense, and actually reversed the case on that basis. From a harm standpoint,
your argument basically that due to Hammer and Johnson, that the protections afforded to children who then go on to engage in sexual activity, let's just say arguably after they have been abused, no longer exist?
No, Your Honor, it's not.
Explain that to me.
If there's no evidentiary link, if the outcry happens completely, the problem in this case is that the outcries are a direct result of the sexual misconduct. You know, if these kids...
Sexual misconduct a direct result of being abused?
Well, for our purposes in the Sixth Amendment analysis, the problem is that it came out because of sexual misconduct. If this child had been caught... Well, suppose she just hadn't been caught. Suppose there had been no problems at school. She's been having sex with boys, but it isn't a problem. She hadn't been thrown out of school. Her parents don't know about it. Say that. And then one day, she goes to her mom and says, I got to tell you something. Dad used to molest me. Then there's no relevance link between how she's having sex now has caused her to make that accusation. In our case...
Mr. Wynn, now isn't that right there, what you just said, the distinction in the expert's testimony, the difference in the expert's approach and in what you're asking us to do? You're saying the prior conduct not related to actions taken in an outcry when the outcry has some stimuli that relates to current conditions and conduct.
Yes, I'm not sure I exactly understand, but I think that when the outcry is related to the injured party's sexual activity, then the injured party's sexual activity is part of her bias or motive, or should be explored as part of her bias or motive.
Okay, and the balance on that at the trial court level or the discretionary rulings made by the trial court to prevent the evidence. Looking at the people, looking at what happened, watching the people testify, you're suggesting is trumped by the idea of Sixth Amendment rights and the right to cross-examine on specific issues of conduct like happened in this case.
Yes, I think that the Sixth Amendment, if you can make the relevance link, the Rule 401, 402 relevance link, does her sexual conduct make it more or less likely that she is making a false outcry?
So I ask you a follow-up question, and that is, when the course of the abuse was over years, as happened in with both of these children, isn't that also a balancing factor to be considered by the trial judge in deciding on a discretionary call about the evidence?
I don't believe it is from the Sixth Amendment standard. I think that when the This is prototypical bias or motive. And I think under Davis versus Alaska, the trial court has no discretion to stop the defense from exploring prototypical bias or motive under the Sixth Amendment.
Because it is so vital to the presentation of the defense that it's required to be allowed.
Yes. And again, I think it's so vital because of what Judge Cochran told us in Hammer. These cases come down to credibility. There is no physical evidence to corroborate at this point.
One other question.
And I'm out of time. May I answer? Okay.
One other question concerning, I think, who you've identified as injured party number two. Her outcry only came about as a result of the outcry of injured party number one. And as I recall the facts, her alleged sexual misconduct was years removed from the outcry. She wasn't trying to get herself out of trouble at that point in time. Do you agree that that's what the facts showed?
Not that she's not trying to get herself out of trouble. Yes, that it is somewhat years removed. And if I may address that. What the record showed was that the second injured party, when they first asked her, is this true? She said, no, she's just trying to get herself out of trouble. And then later came back in, and the defense theory and what they would have been able to argue to the jury is, look, injured party two knows injured party one is in trouble for all this. She knows that there's a pretty good chance she's fixing to get thrown under the bus too. So if she jumps on the train of let's blame dad, it sort of clears the decks for her going forward. And we go,
years removed sexual misconduct that you argue should have been admitted, how does that come in under the same theory as the more recent conduct of injured party number one?
Because the evidence link is she had exposure to being in trouble with her parents for it. And by blaming her dad, she preemptively gets herself out of trouble and clears the decks for herself. And now you may think that that's a strong or weak link, but it's something that the jury is entitled to consider when they're deciding if they believe these two girls. And I would submit to you that adding that extra bias or motive, I mean, obviously we have a prior inconsistent statement because the first thing she said was, no, that never happened. And that got before the jury. But you take the prior inconsistent statement and you add to it bias or motive, then maybe the jury looks at it in a different light. And for purposes of the Constitution, purposes of confrontation, when we have these cases where credibility is the issue, the jury should know everything they can, especially about these specific biases in making these determinations, especially in these cases where people can get these 25-year-plus sentences with no option for parole. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wynn.
May it please the court. First, I'd like to clear up a little terminology. I may refer to the complaint of the victims, complainants, however you want to phrase it, as A and S, their first initials. Counsel has referred to them as AP1 and AP2. I think it keeps it straighter for purposes of at least the state's brief, but also A is actually older than S, and that AP1, who corresponds to S, as he's referring, and AP2 corresponds to A. So he's actually reversed the age. I don't know about you guys, but for me, it's just easier to keep them straight as older sister, younger sister, A and S, as opposed to AP1 and AP2 and getting all the nomenclature confused. So if I refer to A and S and you can't follow, please just alert me and I will try and put it in AP1 and AP2 terms. I'm going to address the 412 issue first and then the confrontation clause issues that they've raised, because the Court of Criminal Appeals and the Supreme Court have said you have to analyze the evidentiary issues first. If it comes in under the evidentiary issue, then and only then do you see whether it violates the Sixth Amendment and should have been admitted over the 412 issue in this case. At the very beginning, however, I would like to stress, or at least remind the court, of the standard review here. It's an abuse of discretion. That is, if the trial court's ruling is within the zone of reasonable disagreement, then even if this court disagrees with the ultimate ruling, it must affirm. The courts have also defined reasonable disagreement as or abuse of discretion as an arbitrary or unreasonable application of the law or an arbitrary or unreasonable ruling in the case.
Well, that was the same standard of review in Johnson.
Yes, it was. And I will get to Johnson in just a minute. Well, I can address Johnson now if you wish.
Go ahead.
Okay. Yes, it is. Looking at 412, 412 differs from 403. 412, what's at issue here is 412 B, C, and B, E, plus 412, 3, 2, B, C. You know what I mean. Under 412 B, 2, C, evidence comes in for, as it relates to motive or bias of the alleged victim, and under 3, the probative value outweighs the danger of unfair prejudice. That's a rule of exclusion. In other words, the evidence under 412, evidence of prior sexual conduct, only comes in if it falls under one of the exceptions, not, which is contrary to Rule 403 and most of the rules of evidence, which are rules of inclusion, which mean they come in unless they fall under one of the exceptions in the rule. Moreover, Section 3 of 412 differs from 403 in that the balancing test is a little bit different. The probative value outweighs the danger of unfair precedent, not, as in 403, whether the probative value is substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair precedents. So while it's easy to fall into it's not substantially outweighed, therefore it shouldn't have come in, that doesn't apply in 412. And in fact, that's the mistake the court makes in Hammer. The court in Hammer says, well, the trial court never actually did a 412 balancing test. We'll do it for them. But then it applies and uses the language from Rule 403 and, in fact, concludes that the probative value is not substantially outweighed. That's not the correct test. The state would suggest that Hammer really doesn't offer a whole lot of precedential value because of that mistake. There are other reasons to differentiate Hammer from the present case. Let me get back to 412. Because of the balance is not substantially outweighed, it's really probative value versus unfair prejudice, means if it's 50-50, the trial court must bar it. The probative value has to outweigh the unfair prejudice before the trial court can let the evidence in, not before it has to bar it. Hope I'm being clear on this. The state maintains that given all the other evidence that came in as to the bias or motive of the A&S, that balance tipped to, the trial court struck the correct balance. It found that the evidence, the marginal value of the added evidence of the specific type of sexual conduct of the two victims did not outweigh the unfair prejudice to them and to their families and so on, as the courts have said. In other words, given that they were able to impeach them with all sorts of various other bias and motives, but most importantly, the fact that S in particular was in trouble and had been in trouble in the past, and they also had abundant evidence, ample evidence, that there had been ongoing and quote, escalating antagonisms between the two girls and their two sets of parents, that it had caused massive problems between the two girls and their two sets of parents, that it had caused massive problems between the various sets of parents and step-parents. Moreover, there was, again, all sorts of evidence that when S made her outcry, that she was in a world of trouble, as the defense counsel phrased it at one point, that it was traumatic, that it was massive, that it caused all sorts of trouble, and she was in deep trouble at the time. The state would suggest that's the key, and that's the key in Hammer and in Johnson. In both Hammer and Johnson, the jury had no jury were not given evidence that at the moment, at the time of the outcry, that the victims who had made the outcry were in some sort of very, very serious trouble. In Hammer, there was evidence that the daughter really resented the father, that he was overbearing, or she thought he was overbearing, that she really resented his presence, she resented living with him, she wanted to get out from living in him. But there was no evidence that she was particularly angry with him because he had taken her to a clinic to undergo a sexual assault examination because he believed he had had sex with her boyfriend. And the jury was kept from knowing that she had lied about that and had accused another boy of having sex with her. That differs from the case here, the state maintains, because the jury was made aware that S was in very, very serious trouble. They just weren't made aware of the specific type of trouble, the specific thing that she had done that got her in trouble. They were even, as counsel suggests, there were hints from what S said at her outcry, that it was of sexual nature, some sort of sexual misconduct. They just weren't told the details. And the state maintains that the probative value of knowing the details of it did not wear the unfair prejudice of getting into it, so long as the jury was aware that she was in trouble. And yes, she had a motive and a bias to make a false allegedly false allegation to get out of that trouble. And there was evidence that A actually articulated that. Her first reaction upon being told that S had made an outcry was she's lying to get her butt out of trouble. That's the key. And that's where this case differs from both Johnson and Hammer. Again, in Johnson, the jury was not made aware of the fact that the victim was molesting, had been accused of and undergoing therapy for incest with his little sister, sexually assaulting his little sister. The jury had no idea. The jury was unaware of how serious he was in and why he would have a motivation to make a false allegation to turn himself in from being an assaulter, a molester, to a victim himself.
Well, isn't that exactly what their argument is here in this case, is that this allegation was made to turn her into a victim rather than a person, you know?
It is. And the state maintains they were allowed to make that argument. They just weren't allowed to get into the very specifics of what the sexual misconduct was, that the probative value of the evidence.
There were hints that it was sexual, but it was hints. It wasn't any kind of real evidence that it was sexual misconduct she was engaged in.
I agree with you that it was tenuous, and given that nobody else repeated that one phrase that S made, dad got me into this because he opened the sexual world to me, something to that effect. Yes, the jury may not have picked up on that, but the jury definitely would have picked up on the fact that she was in a world of trouble, massive trouble, all sorts of trouble, that she'd been in serious trouble before, but now she was even in more serious trouble, and that in order to get out of that serious trouble, she would concoct an allegation. Moreover, the state, following your suggestion, yes, the evidence of misconduct or alleged sexual conduct by A is very much removed. A was a senior in high school by that time. The sexual misconduct they tried to introduce occurred in ninth grade, two instances in ninth grade. They were relatively minor, in the great scheme of sexual misconduct, extremely relatively minor. So in terms of severity and timeliness, shouldn't have come in. The only other serious one was that she had made an admission that she was engaging in sex with her boyfriend to the stepmother, appellant's husband. But she also, it was uncontested that she was, the parent, the stepmother and appellant never did anything about it. Didn't counsel her against it, didn't warn her against it, didn't punish her for it, said nothing to her. There's no evidence of that. So she, at that point, there's no motivation for her to make a false allegation at that point. She's not trying to fade the heat from some sort of sexual conduct or misconduct or trouble for it. Again, we're coming back to it's the whole idea of being in trouble, not the whole idea of engaging in some sort of sexual conduct. You're not buying it.
Just thinking. That's
no.
All.
I've lost my train of thought.
It's our judge. Oh. It's our part to be the judge of what she's thinking over here.
I shouldn't. To the confrontation clause issue, the state maintains that the trial court correctly balanced it under 412 and kept it out because the probative value of what the specific type of sexual conduct was extremely minimal, and the unfair prejudice was pretty high. It would expose these girls to all sorts of, the cases go on and on about why it's unfair. So that leads us to whether, nevertheless, given that the 412 ruling was correct, was it incorrect under the confrontation clause? The state maintains that it wasn't. The confrontation clause standard is whether the failure to admit the evidence would prohibit the defendant from cross-examining a witness concerning possible motives, bias, and prejudices to such an extent that he could not present a vital defensive theory. Here, he clearly did. They raised five vital defensive theories. They particularly hammered the defensive theory that S was simply trying to get herself out of trouble and made a false allegation. Moreover, Johnson and Van Arsdale, the Supreme Court case of Van Arsdale, have sort of rephrased the test of the Confrontation Clause violation as questioning whether the jury would have might have received a significantly different impression of the witness's credibility had the defendant's counsel been permitted to pursue his proposed line of cross-examination. The state would maintain under that standard, allowing the defense to adduce evidence of the specific sexual conduct would not have significantly changed the jury's impression of either witness. To touch on the harmless error analysis very briefly, two things. First, the state did brief the issue under 404B. I'm so sorry. 442A, I'm sorry, as though it were a constitutional violation. However, if this court finds that it's not a constitutional violation but did violate 412, then the correct analysis would be under 44.2B, which the state didn't brief. Happy to brief if you want. If you ask for a brief on the issue, the brief would have gotten way out of control had we done it otherwise. The state maintains that it wasn't a violation under 44.2A, so it couldn't possibly be a violation under 44.2B. Moreover, to touch very briefly on what you touched on, Justice Gabriel, if the trial court erred in under 412 or the confrontation clause, it was most probably under admitting evidence of S's sexual conduct, which would have impeached S, arguably. Well, in order to find a violation, you would have had to find that. But just impeaching S, in terms of harmless error analysis, you've still got the testimony of A, and A's motivation to, I'm out of time, and I at least finished the sentence. A's motivation to make a false allegation is extremely tenuous. They have to jump through a bunch of hoops to get there. That she's doing it just to stick up for her sister because she's always hated him, which there was evidence she's always hated him anyway, and the jury clearly rejected that.
Respond to their argument that due to the expert testifying to this sensory and peripheral details coming from their consensual activity with someone other than their father opens the door to this.
I'll address that in three quick points. First, I take dispute with what counsel suggested the forensic examiner testified about in terms of sensory perceptions. The sensory perceptions she testified to were more concrete details. The where, what room were you in, who was present, who wasn't there, what time of day it was, that sort of thing. Not how did it feel, how did it smell, how did it look, which makes a difference in terms of whether this evidence of prior sexual conduct is relevant at all. It wouldn't be if the emphasis there is on the sensory in terms of the who, what, where, why, you know, that sort of thing. Second of all, the forensic expert was put on simply to testify that given her analysis of their various memory and perceptions, she didn't believe they were coached, or it suggested they hadn't been coached. So again, evidence of their sexual conduct would make it more or less probable that they had been coached or not coached. And the third one was that I got caught up in my first two. I think I do believe it's in the brief.
Okay.
Thank State you, praise Mr. for an affirmance.
May it please the court. I'd like to start where he left off, the rebuttal to the forensic interviewer. The problem was they didn't tailor the forensic interviewer's testimony to those specific points. She testified pretty much in general. These are the kinds of things you look for. These are the kinds of things I saw in these interviews. And one of them in particular was, how do things feel? And it's not narrowed down in her testimony so as to limit what the jury would consider her testimony for. Secondly, I think Hammer is correctly decided, and I think that the important thing we get from Hammer is this difference between the rules and the Constitution. What Judge Cochran is really saying is you have to try to interpret the rules in harmony with what the Constitution requires. And when you look at Rule 412b2c, quote, relates to, doesn't say is dispositive of or conclusively proves, says it's admissible if it relates to a victim's motive or bias. You look at Rule 613B that talks about cross-examining someone concerning bias or motive. If you are to interpret those in harmony with the Constitution, which is what Judge Cochran says we're supposed to do, then I would submit under those standards the judge did abuse his discretion in admitting this stuff under Rule 412 and under Rule 613, which we have included as points of error in our brief.
Mr. Wynn.
Yes, Your Honor.
You started your presentation stating that the real issue in this case and the function of the trial judge's admission and ruling to exclude evidence all comes down to the question of credibility of the two girls.
Yes, Your Honor.
So the vital core of the theory of defense presented by the defense in this case is that these two girls were lying.
Yes, Your Honor.
That was presented to the jury. What wasn't presented was the efforts that you're now contending should have been, the evidence that should have been allowed in by the trial court of subsequent conduct years later, in reflecting on the testimony of the witnesses concerning their outcries and the incidents that they identified that had occurred years before multiple times.
Yes, Your Honor.
Am I got that right?
Yes, Your Honor. You do. And the reason is the defense, the Sixth Amendment tells us bias or motive is absolutely prototypical impeachment that a jury is supposed to be able to consider. And What happened in this case, and I think this ties back to harm more than does whether or not it's error, the defense was hamstrung in trying to prove up bias or motive. So we know the girls are in trouble, but we have no idea what it's for. We don't even know the general criteria or the general category that this misconduct that they're in trouble for is in. We don't know that it's, quote, sexual misconduct. I mean, regardless of the details that it was in the, that she had sex or was having sexual contact with somebody in the boys' bathroom, we don't know that it's sexual in nature. I mean, the jury, for all they know, she's been staying up too late watching TV instead of doing her homework, and her parents are sick of it. For all the jury knows, she was smoking outside of school and got in trouble for that. For all the jury knows, she went to a party and was drinking and has gotten in trouble for that. We don't know. And more importantly, the jury doesn't know. And without knowing the sexual nature of the conduct and the sexual nature of the conduct that immediately precipitated the first time that either of these girls told anyone anything about this, they can't, the jury was not in a position to make the vital credibility determination that was necessary to find Mr. Hill guilty. And in this case, if you look at Hammer and you look at Johnson, I would submit this case is exactly like Johnson. I mean, it goes down the line. You didn't get to know. I mean, they knew in general the kid was in trouble. They didn't know the nature of it. And it was the sexual nature that got Johnson reversed. As we said in our brief, I mean, if you just put it this way, I think a rational juror can certainly conclude that a teenage girl is more likely to make a false accusation that she has been molested if she is trying to deflect blame from herself for having sexual conduct or sexual contact that was not okay with her parents. And I think the Sixth Amendment was violated, and we request that this you reverse the judgment of the Court of Appeals and send this back for a new trial.
Thank you, Mr. Wynn.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wilkinson. Your case is submitted, and you are free to go about your business. And if the lawyers in the next case would move forward, I think we're next hearing City of Denton versus Brian Rushing, Calvin Patterson, and Kevin Marshall.
May I ask a procedural question?
Yes, sir.
Can I file a letter brief, or do I need to file a motion for leave and then with it?
You can file a letter brief. Okay. And Mr. Wilkinson, you can have 5 days to respond if you need to the letter brief.
Okay.